This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. How to make insurance interesting. That's State Farm archivist Buck Farley's job.
Telling somebody about how we expanded across the United States as a company, and then they're sitting there and go, that is the coolest story I've ever heard in my life.
Ryan Denham reports on what's in State Farm's basement, plus a cameo from Ed Russ Jr. Plus, meet two foster parents, parents to kids, parents to rescued puppies. Yes, it will give you the feels. John Norton previews one of the acts in this year's GLT Summer Concert set for early next month, the Something Brothers. And Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner stops by. That and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Critics of Bloomington Normal's bus system say its governing board needs to better reflect riders, and Bloomington city leaders are being asked to make that happen. One of many issues that surfaced last night at Bloomington's city council meeting. Here in studio to recap it is Mayor Terry Renner. Thanks for coming in today.
Always a pleasure, Charlie. Thank you.
A group called Citizens to Ensure Fair Transit has raised concerns about current leadership at Connect Transit and recent decisions on route changes and fare increases. They say it's disproportionately affecting the poor and riders with disabilities. This dispute over transit has been going on for just over a month now. What do you make of their concerns and how Connect Transit has responded?
Well, I think it's obviously the Connect Transit has made substantial progress over the last several years, and you know they certainly deserve that. The board is obviously well-intentioned, but essentially people who are dependent upon Connect Transit are going to tend to be less affluent, and it is really important for us to keep that in mind as we take a look at having a more mobile workforce, which is really critical for our community, and to make sure that people can get from point A to point B. We have to take their perspectives into consideration. And I'm not saying that the Connect Transit Board has not, but it does not seem to be unreasonable, as several had suggested last evening, including some Bloomington City Council members, that perhaps a seat be reserved for someone who is not able-bodied or maybe someone who has to use Connect Transit system. So that I think that would involve addition rather than subtraction. One question was, how could we do this with respect to bylaws or ordinances, and how would we do it given that both Bloomington and Normal appoint members?
So you have a 7-member board. 4 members are appointed by Bloomington. Do you think something needs to change with either current board members or how the board itself is constituted in numbers?
My thought on it would be, to expand maybe from 7 to 9. Alderman Black last night suggested doubling the size of the board. I don't know. I think that might be a little too much. But I think definitely making sure that you have voices of your constituents that are actually on the board is, I think, actually not an unreasonable request. And this doesn't necessarily mean that the recent decisions were not made for the best reasons, that serving the greater number for the greatest good is really important. But Bloomington and Normal are, of course, at the table because we give money and we appoint the Connect Transit board members. We can't, as some had asked us last night, you know, will you change the route? Will you restore the Olive Line? We don't do that directly. What we do is try to work with our partners in Connect Transit.
So you want some stakeholder buy-in.
Absolutely.
And diversity.
Absolutely.
But you also want people who are going to look at the community as a whole. How do you slice that dynamic to get members to reflect community interests rather than simply stakeholder interests?
Well, I think it's essentially the way that if you've got, again, there's no magic number. I was just suggesting that if the board were to expand from 7 to 9 and you had one of each, let's say reserved, you have voices and votes as well as others who you do have to have people looking for the out for the bottom line as well. You know, what can we afford? What, you know, what's the cost and what's the benefit to the community? Alderman Black last night, and I believe Alderwoman Carrillo had suggested some perhaps trying having free fares. What would that cost? Would that increase ridership? How helpful would that be? I think that is probably something that would be too costly, but I don't know. Let's take a look at it and let's see what the benefits might be in order to increase ridership.
So one of your transit appointees, Ryan Whitehouse, says if we don't look at making some changes, Connect Transit will be out of money by 2023. What is your understanding of the financial pressures facing Connect Transit? How bad is it?
I don't know that. Depends on what you mean by out of money. I mean, it's a little like the Social Security system, right? You know that there are certain issues. All public transit systems in metro areas are facing some sort of financial difficulties, and they've all got to make that trade-off between the quality of service that they provide to their community, and especially in a multimodal future urban environment that we're facing, and having their bottom line, and in making sure that they can make their bills. Well, obviously there are the city of Bloomington and the town of Normal have stepped up and giving money, as well as making sure that we had extra money to make sure we have Sunday service, which was, I think, very, very important. And that's important for our business community. It's important for the people who are the workers and all of us. I mean, if we go to a store and we buy something on a Sunday, even if we're not a business owner, if we're not a worker, we're benefiting from that. And I think it's also something that we have to understand as a quality of life issue for the future of Bloomington Normal. We want to be a multimodal city for the future with a strong mass transit system, and I think we will. I don't see any, there's certainly no flinching on my end, or I don't think my council, and I don't think that there is on with the town of Normal.
So the 2023 date is predicated on the idea that the federal grant can be used, is intended for capital purchases of buses, mm-hmm. but it can be used for operations. And at the rate at which costs are rising, by 2023, the entire federal grant will have to go toward operations and leave Connect Transit without a way to replenish its rolling stock, as it were. So that is the out-of-money part of that. And very quickly, if you run out of current buses, you're going to be out of service. What needs to happen?
Well, in once again, you know, we're talking about many buses that are recent purchases. They're not going to need to be replaced in a few years from now.
No, lot of them are aging buses. According to Connect Transit.
Yeah, but there are a whole core. In fact, I was out. I forgot what it was, but it was about 2 years ago when I was out. And there was a special ribbon cutting for brand new buses that were purchased, and larger buses than were necessary at that point, because they felt that there was going to be growth. So I think that at the end of the day, those are the kinds of issues that you have to be worried about. But I don't know that I would use the term, you know, going broke, or we wouldn't be able to operate. Like anything else, this is a service that is critical. And it will evolve. We'll see what happens with federal grants. We'll see what happens with state grants. We'll see what happens with ridership, as well as Bloomington and Normal. We need to have a strong Connect Transit public system for a lot of reasons. And I think some of this was brought up last night by some of the members of the council. If we have more people riding buses, we don't have as many cars on the road. We save some money with respect to street repairs and infrastructure, et cetera, and congestion, other environmental kinds of issues. So I'm confident that we're going to be continuing to make progress irrespective of those challenges.
Does that mean, though, that to maintain a strong Connect Transit, you would be willing to find additional money within city government, either new or existing, to send to them to alleviate some financial pressure?
It depends on what those are and what we're getting in return. Obviously, ultimately, the council would have to make that determination, and I'd have to sign it, but I would, it depends on what the situation is. At this point, I don't know that we know. And we certainly don't have hard numbers. And actually, fairly shortly, we're going to have a report from Connect Transit to the City Council to give us an annual update on what's going on, what's the ridership, what do things look like today, 1 year out, 2 years out. And the other thing that we're working on, which is really until just a few weeks ago was the primary thing that we'd been talking about with Connect Transit for the better part of a couple of years, is to have a downtown transfer center. And that could really be something we use as a public-private partnership that's an anchor in part of our downtown redevelopment.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mayor Terry Renner is here. It's a busy time in Springfield in the last couple weeks of the scheduled spring session. Sometimes they go over, though. Lots of big proposals in motion. Legalized marijuana, hopes for a capital bill, just to name a couple. You and several city council members were in Springfield recently for the Illinois Municipal League's Lobby Day. What were you pushing?
Actually, mainly we were pushing for capital improvements, for capital improvement programs for our downtown transfer station with Connect Transit, as well as the Hamilton Road extension, perhaps money for our downtown and O'Neill Pool. And that is the O'Neill Pool, not just to make Band-Aid changes, but to turn it into an aquatic center. And our police chief, Clay Wheeler, actually at our recent kind of council retreat, had publicly urged the council to go forward and make that kind of investment in the $12.7 or so million dollar aquatic center.
Why would that matter to a police chief?
Because that's one of the critical things that will be important for youth and others in the summer on the west side of Bloomington. And as he put it, will make their jobs easier because there'll be people who are more occupied, younger people who are more occupied, and there'll be less crime.
You had talked about bringing that project back for a second look rather than just a Band-Aid approach to be a more encompassing look at that. Following the election, you had mentioned that here on Sound Ideas. What's next for that? What's the timeline?
Well, probably in June, potentially July. I mean, if the council is going to make a budgetary amendment, which is what it would require, because the current budget has essentially keeps O'Neill Pool as an O'Neill Pool rather than O'Neill Pool as an aquatic center, then that would have to come by the middle of the summer at the latest in order to make sure that this was in progress by the fall, by the building season.
State Senator Jason Berrickman said Monday on Sound Ideas that his view of chances for the capital bill are fading, receding. He questions whether there are enough votes to do a gas tax, which would be there are some other ways to pay for an infrastructure bill, but that's the major way. What's your sense of that after going to Springfield?
Pretty much everybody that we spoke with on both sides of the aisle thought that there was no doubt that there would be some sort of capital bill. Now, what that looks like, who knows? Who gets that money? That's the, pun intended, silver dollar question. But from what we could tell, maybe something has changed since we went there a little over a week ago. But that was the sense of the people that we spoke with. And of course, as we do that, we've not had one since I've been mayor. So it's been at least 7 years. I've been mayor for 6 years. It's been at least 7 years. And so I think that there are any number of projects that we could use the money for. It's critical to invest in capital expenditures. They literally are long-term investments.
One of the proposals is to make the revenue sources for this capital bill indexed to inflation so we don't have to have it be a tentpole once-in-a-decade event, that it could be a rolling, smaller piece of capital and infrastructure investment by the state. What's your thought on that?
That makes a lot of sense, although in the short run we've got a lot to make up for since we really didn't have a budget for the bulk of the last half decade.
What do you think of the current marijuana legislation that's being considered in Springfield, the one that Governor Pritzker came out in support of a few weekends ago?
Well, as long as there is a local control and as a local opt-out, I'm definitely in favor of legalization of recreational marijuana. It's coming. It's coming throughout the United States. It's coming in many other communities. And frankly, it also helps eliminate some of the black market. And it will help many communities balance their budget, to be really honest. And without raising current taxes, as I should put it.
McLean County Sheriff John Sandage issued a statement yesterday saying legalized marijuana will be a significant increase in burden on law enforcement. He criticized the bill for devoting only 8% of its new tax revenue toward crime prevention. What are you hearing from the police department, and what's your sense of that issue?
The main thing My sense of that is, I don't know whether it should be 8% or 15%. Certainly Sheriff Sandage would know better than I would. But certainly from our police department, one of the main concerns that we would want to have is be certain and have the equipment necessary to determine whether or not somebody was too high to drive when they were pulled over, a little like breathalyzers for alcohol. So that's perhaps our main concern. That, again, we're also not reinventing the wheel. We can talk to people in Colorado or California and other places where they've legalized this. And there's quite a bit of information. I'm going to the U.S. Conference of Mayors in a few weeks, and there are several panels on marijuana legalization.
So if local control is important to have, does that signal that you would not want a dispensary for legalized recreational cannabis in town?
I would want to opt in. I just think that communities generally have the option to opt out if they so choose. So if there's a particular town that doesn't want to, that's up to them. I would certainly hope, and I would veto any attempt for Bloomington to opt out. I think that it's important for a variety of reasons. And actually, one of the things that the research in other states have shown is that the people who currently use recreational marijuana are going to continue to use recreational marijuana. They're just going to buy it and we're going to tax it. And you're going to largely eliminate the black market. Ironically, perhaps the people that increase their use of marijuana are the baby boomers, people that are nearly 50 and older who may have used marijuana recreationally when they were in college, but are law-abiding citizens now, and that seems to be the biggest growth market.
How do you feel about local grow, the home grow provisions?
Because I have no problem with that at all.
5, 10, 20, what should the number be for
plants? I don't know
what
the number should be. I don't know about 20 plants, but I don't know what that number should be. I think just looking at other communities and other states that have gone down this path, again, we don't have to reinvent the wheel, but I absolutely, again, if it's legal, it's legal. And I think that it is statewide, and I think that it's really a great idea also to take a look at people who have, for small to modest amounts of marijuana possession in the past, have had felony convictions. I think that that's really, really important for us to have a much more equitable society in Illinois as we go forward.
Put your political scientist hat on for a second. There's some concern by the State Prosecutors Association that having expungement come from the legislature is constitutionally impermissible. Okay. What's your thinking on that?
And again, that could be. It may be that what we need is a constitutional amendment in order to make that happen. I think it's important enough to make it happen in whatever way is necessary in order to do what's right. And I think I think it is absolutely something that's right as we move forward. Because essentially, if you're a felon and you're a convicted felon, it ruins your life. And if now what you did, perhaps growing a certain number of plants in your home, is now illegal, is now legal, then we say, oh, tough, sorry. When you did it, it was a felony. Today we're doing it and it's legal and it's not a problem. And I think that that's a very serious concern because it affects people's ability to get a job. It affects their livelihood, all kinds of things.
State Senator Jason Berrickman has been on record saying the proposed expungement provision allowing expungement for up to 500 grams of possession instead of the 30 that would be legal contradicts the existing criminal code. So he's against that contradiction. What is your thought about the conflict between the criminal code and the expungement provision as currently articulated in the bill?
I don't know exactly what level would be necessary or what's important, but I think regardless of whether or not there happens to be inconsistencies, Jason Berrickman is an attorney. I would certainly defer to him in terms of legalities. I'm talking as a mayor and trying to do what's right. What's right for our community, what's right for our state, what's right for human beings, and what's right for human equality as we go forward. And those are my concerns.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mayor Terry Renner is here talking about issues in Springfield as well as in the city of Bloomington. Owners of electric vehicles would be hit harder under the proposed capital bill The current annual registration for electric vehicles is $17. A new fee would be $1,000 per year. We have an electric automaker just down the road in Rivian. What do you think of such a sharp increase in EV registration fees?
My own opinion is, if certainly in Bloomington, you know, if we were raising taxes by anything like that, we would phase them in. In fact, I don't think we'd do it in terms of at that level. But at the end of the day, if you have a small car, it's going to cost you $100-some for your license plate. It's going to cost you gas taxes that you pay for throughout the year. And you're using the roads and are probably having the same wear and tear as an electric vehicle. So I think getting to the point where there's rough parity between electric vehicles and similarly situated gasoline engines, I think, is a good idea. Maybe you don't do it in one fell swoop.
Chemists, physicists tend to say, in studies from transportation departments, tend to say that the biggest single damaging factor for roads is over-the-road trucking. And yet their fees are not commensurate with the damage.
Not at all.
Big political hurdle. How do you address that in the city of Bloomington?
Well, in the city of Bloomington, I don't know that we can do a whole lot about the power of the trucking industry in our state capitals and certainly in Washington, but that is absolutely the case. They're definitely some of the greatest, obviously because of the weight, because of the frequency of making trips. You could potentially have a greater tax on diesel, but we can't do that here locally in Bloomington. That has to be a state or federal issue.
I've been asking this a couple different times over the last several months. It's an issue that's been on the back burner until after the election. Where do you think a soccer complex or a multi-sport complex is going to go? Is that dead, 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 or is there still a faint breath of life left?
Oh, there's probably a faint breath of life left. I think we have to do something about soccer, given that our soccer fields are immediately under the runway at the airport. Whether or not there is a soccer complex is another question in terms of what it might look like. Can you really put together a deal that's primarily funded by the private sector, by a private investment? Maybe it's near orthopedic surgeons, maybe it's near others. I mean, some people have suggested a variety of ways in which there are affinities between the private sector and private sector businesses and a soccer field where they would bear most of the burden. And it's just, it's all a question of money. I don't think it would be a great asset to our community, especially if it were right by one of our interstates. But there is a question of money. We've talked about a lot of resources. We've got a lot of needs of infrastructure. We've got a lot of needs throughout our community, O'Neill Pool, downtown, other issues. We've got a lot of demands on our budget.
If you, as a mayor, are willing to put $12 million towards O'Neill Pool and that aquatic complex, what should the city be willing to put toward a multi-sport complex in a public-private partnership?
Well, first of all, those are sort of apples and oranges. One is absolutely clearly a community asset that also might very well, especially since it's right near the interstates, get some economic development. It's also an equity issue, I believe, in terms of parks. You've got some parks that look like the Taj Mahal on the east side. You've got very little on the west side. And so for a variety of reasons, I strongly support the O'Neill Pool. That is different. Not totally. I mean, it deals with recreation. It does deal with economic development from what we would do for a soccer complex. But that soccer complex, it depends on what it looks like and what it is. Where is it? What are some of the projections? Again, at the abstract level, I know much more about O'Neill Pool and what it might do. I know much less about a hypothetical soccer complex that may or may not even happen.
That's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Thanks, Charlie.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next time, you'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Koos. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
Support for GLT comes from the CH3 Satellite Cafe, the boutique coffee shop from Coffee Hound nestled inside Bloomington Cycle, serving specialty handcrafted beverages. Open 7 to 5 Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 Saturdays, and 9 to 4 Sundays, with ample patio seating at 915 East Washington in Bloomington. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, John Norton previews one of the acts coming to the GLT Summer Concert in early June in downtown Bloomington. Usually, you will find historians and archivists at universities or museums, logging and explaining a world of knowledge to the next generation. For big companies like State Farm, their own histories need a similar attention to detail. GLT's Ryan Denham visits State Farm's archive and brings back this report.
I don't get a lot of visitors in the basement, unfortunately. A lot of people don't know I'm down here.
That's okay, because a big part of Buck Farley's job is to bring history out into the world, to find stories and actionable research hidden in drawers and old binders. That said, he does occasionally get a visitor.
One second.
Sure.
Hey.
Hi, Mr. Rust.
Who it is?
Believe anything. One of the best storytellers.
How you doing? That's Ed Rust Jr., the retired CEO of State Farm, a.k.a. one of the most powerful people in Bloomington-Normal for a lot of years. He stepped down in 2015. Rust popped by, unscheduled during my visit with Farley last week.
How are you?
Fine.
I boxed up your office. Did you see that?
The one thing I was going to say...
Well, Buck, I got to put on my skeptical journalist hat, because before I asked you, do you get visitors very often in the archive in the basement, you said, no, nobody comes to see me in the basement. I'm all by myself down here. And then literally Ed Rust Jr. just walked down here just to say hi and to pick up something. So I guess that happens sometimes?
Yeah. Mr. Rust and I have been working very closely together since his retirement to preserve his legacy at State Farm and to tell his story and his family's story. Obviously, the Rust family has had a huge impact on State Farm and its success today. I'll probably have a close relationship with Ed now for a while because he has a lot of history to tell me.
And Farley had a lot of history to tell me. We spent an hour walking around his archive underneath State Farm corporate headquarters. They've got nearly 60,000 unique objects in this collection, plus millions of photos and thousands of hours of audio and video. Farley went to Illinois State University, hoping to be a history teacher, and he worked as an archaeologist. 5 years ago, he became State Farm's archivist. He admits it's a little different being a historian at one of the biggest companies in the world, rather than working in academia or at a museum.
Telling the stories of the past to people and seeing their eyes bright up when an understanding comes across their face or a connection clicks with them. Telling somebody about how we expanded across the United States as a company, and then they're sitting there and going, that is the coolest story I've ever heard in my life. It's making insurance interesting for people and getting them to fall in love with who we are as a company, you know.
Farley is just full of fun facts and quick anecdotes. He told me about the youngest State Farm agent ever from the 1930s.
He was 12. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Or why the company once bought a whole fleet of Singer sewing machines to more quickly tie together policies and applications.
And we went up to about 1,000 in an hour. We're like, wow, this is an amazing technological improvement.
Or why the iconic State Farm Atlas from the World War II era has such a hot commodity.
This was the only time we put a map of the world in one of our atlases, and the reason why we did that is so our insureds could see where their sons and daughters were going during the war.
Trivia is fun, but there are also more useful applications of this collection and knowledge. The blueprints for the downtown Bloomington building, for example, have come in handy as they wind it down and prepare for its sale. Farley says doing research for executives and other employees is a big part of his job.
People don't live 100 years or typically don't work 100 years. And sometimes there could have been something that happened in the past that people have forgotten about. Like, hey, let's try starting a new company or a new initiative. Have we ever done this before? I don't know. Let's ask the archivist. And the archivist typically has the information to provide to them and the details of, you know, was it a success? Was it not? You know, can we change it around to make it different?
The scope of State Farm's archive is a bit staggering, which makes sense since State Farm is the largest home and auto insurer in the U.S. There are model cars, old employee and agent publications like Alfie and Reflector, a full-size Neighbor costume, the Employer Support Freedom Award it got from the Obama administration for its Military Affinity Employee Program. And that is the sound of a life bell. They date back to the 1930s, when agents and later operations staff began ringing a bell every time they binded a new life policy. only reason they had a bell is because an executive needed a way to call meetings at the downtown Bloomington building, so he grabbed a train bell. Farley recently relayed that story to current employees who can still ring bells when they bind policies.
And they said, we always wondered why we stand up and ring a bell for this type of thing, and now we understand where it came from. And I'm like, yeah, it came from 1935.
A slightly more unusual item in the archive is a crystal ball. It was used by a colorful executive named Morris Fuller decades ago, a rather ingenious way to speed up staff meetings inside the sweltering downtown building.
And Morris Fuller, all he's doing is standing there like watching you the whole time. And this goes on for like an hour. Finally, he holds his hands up and he says, wait a minute. And he walks over to this corner. He brings this crystal ball out and he has a podium rigged. And he sets it on this podium and he says, crystal ball, what do you think we should do? He puts his hands on the side and he pushes a button and it flickers and lights up. And he looks up and he says, crystal ball said we're doing this. And they believed him because they didn't have any reason not to.
The downtown Bloomington building has yielded a lot of treasure for the archive, especially recently. That's because State Farm has moved out, is getting ready to sell its former headquarters. That sale is set to close this summer, and the buyer wants to turn it into a mixed-use space for a restaurant, co-working tenants, and other office space.
There's several pieces down there that we wanted to preserve, mainly our founder's furniture. There's several offices down there that held executive furniture down there from the past. So Adley Rust furniture. Adley Rust was our third president of State Farm. Obviously, the Rust family had been with State Farm since 1922 with the founding of the company. George Mahurl's furniture was down there, so we've pulled that out. Recently, we've tried to salvage the time capsules from the downtown facility. And efforts are ongoing to this point in time, and we hope to showcase that material at a later date at a facility that we're currently working on here at corporate headquarters. So
ultimately, these are all objects, though, things you can hold in your hand or photograph or stick on a shelf. In the years ahead, Farley's job is going to get a whole lot harder because of all the digital artifacts that need preservation.
It's not just something that's unique to the State Farm Archive, but archives across the country in general. Archives are traditionally set up for paper and physical objects. So in the new digital environment, there's a scramble right now to try to preserve this stuff because the items that went digital are, it's about that time frame when archives would be collecting that material, 10, 15, 20 years into the past. That's what I struggle with every day. And because back in the day, it was a Western Union telegram from George Mahurl to Minnie Jones on, and I have those telegrams, that's easy. But when it's emails between executives on, let's start a new company, blah, 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 that's the hard stuff to collect because now you're dealing with email chains that are huge. People are like, I don't need this email. I'm going to hit delete. It's gone. It's gone forever. Like, I'll never be able to get it back. So it's more about just continuously trying to ingrain into people, this is what I use, this is what I research, and this is what I need. So please don't delete it. If you're done with it, send it to me, and I'll make sure that it's preserved.
Aside from that challenge, Farley is tasked with bringing State Farm's history out into the world. The new atrium at corporate headquarters is shaped around that history. A massive four-story mural made up of around 15,000 photos of past and present employees overlooks the atrium.
There's George with his Model T, probably a pretty iconic photo. Everybody's kind of seen it.
1935 fire department truck is parked in the atrium too, a throwback to the days when insurance companies owned fire companies. History is splashed all over the inside of new cubbyhole work areas just off the atrium.
What we've tried to do is incorporate our heritage within everyday workspace. So that way, learning about our history isn't at a special event like one of my presentations or a tour of the company. It's something that you can learn every day.
State Farm is old, with many companies sending generations of children into the company. But as it tries to recruit and retain the next generation of employees, its history is part of the sell. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can see a photo gallery from GLT's visit to the State Farm Archive at WGLT.org.
This station works hard to cover the news, but some stories shake our worldview so much we just can't hear them. As headlines accelerate and media proliferate, how we make sense of the world is changing. What's real, what's not. Let On the Media be your guide. Listen for On the Media Sunday morning at 9 on GLT News and Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from SmartVet, the only mobile veterinary practice serving the Bloomington-Normal area. Your pet's healthcare experience is simplified when the vet comes to you. Details at thesmartvet.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, puppies, puppies, puppies. You'll get the feels. Something Brothers guitarist Edwin Pierce says it was surprisingly easy for band members to create and record new music together despite a nearly 30-year studio hiatus and missing a key band member as well. A reunion performance by the legendary Bloomington Normal outfit in 2017 morphed into the group's first full album since the early 1990s. The 10-song Apollo was released in 2018. In this encore broadcast ahead of their GLT Summer Concert appearance on June 8th, Pierce and vocalist and lyricist Scott Wilson reviewed the album with GLT's John Norton. Pierce likened writing and recording with bandmates after all those years to getting back on a bicycle.
Yeah, I mean, it comes naturally to us. I mean, honestly, it really, if we got one gift, is we're able to, you just see it. You just hear it and you go, that's it. And I don't know why, but there's some kind of an intuitive thing that we have.
It was pretty spooky, actually, like when we first got into the practice rehearsal space and started fleshing out these songs. It just was so weird how it just felt like it hadn't been 30 years. It seemed like we were just in the studio together 5 months ago.
So, yeah, for instance, a lot of my things, because I've been playing bass guitar a lot, came in as bass demos. Tommy's didn't come in as electric guitar stuff. He came in as an acoustic. I'd listen to his thing as an acoustic, and I'm going, I'm not so quite seeing the vision quite yet. And then Scott would go put the lyric to it, and then we'd get the electric guitars on, and all of a sudden it went from a nice kind of acoustic song to one hell of a rock song. So,
well, can you give me an example of one song? Can you think of one
Yucca
song?
Yucca Flat was
Yucca
one of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it was like an acoustic.
Yeah, the riff was on acoustic. Everything was on acoustic. And then when it came out to actually fleshing it out, it turned out to be a rip-roaring, you know, rock your head off song, which I was shocked, actually. But I was really happy.
Set me up in Yucca Flat. Brand new suit and a Sunday hat. There's my wife. She's looking fine. Just sit right down here next to me for a while.
Yucca Flat is from the new album Apollo by the Something Brothers, their first album in nearly 30 years. Let's talk about the concept itself. The name of the album is Apollo, and there are numerous references to space, looking down from space, spaceships, right? Earthbound is another one. I mean, there's just all these...
It was weird that way. It's pretty accidental, to tell you.
It was. And let's play the... Let me be part of Fuzzle, which opens up...
That's the one I was going to...
There we go.
Ed had written this demo. His working title was Fuzzle. I always like to use someone's working title as potential lyric jumping off points. And I was asking him what Fuzzle meant. He goes, I have no idea. I was thinking it was just a silly made up word. And I was thinking about how children make silly made up words. And all of a sudden I started thinking about old toys. And my favorite toy of all time was the G.I. Joe space capsule, the Gemini space capsule, you know, that I got for Christmas in 1966 and just went crazy over the thing. And I thought, I'm going to write a song about this space capsule toy, and then it just naturally turned into referencing other toys in it. And so it's kind of like a song about a kid's version of what it might be like to be in space. He's, you know, he's referencing the
Etch-a-Sketch.
The Etch-a-Sketch and a Spirograph and a Kaleidoscope and all these things, because he couldn't think of what to call this thing in the capsule that made the retro rockets fire. He goes, oh, I'll just call it an Etch-a-Sketch. And so it's kind of just about this kid, a child in space. Well, and as some of the other songs started almost accidentally having these references, we thought, well, let's just kind of go with that. There probably was a few other songs that I thought, okay, well, let's do another one with some kind of space theme, and then I did wrote Apollo. When's the mission to Mars? I steal a ride in a baggage car. I'll be out of my brain on the 550.
Scott actually captured the probably his best vocal ever, and I think it's on Apollo. Every time I hear that, I really listen to his voice and just go like, holy crap, this is Scott at his top of his game. That vocal just comes off sincere. It just sounds sweet. I was like, wow.
I quit smoking too. Which might have something to do.
Scott Lee Wilson, Edwin Pierce of the Something Brothers in studio. This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. Love Lens, is that an older song?
It is, yeah. We started playing that one toward
the very end. But
maybe like in 1990.
It's that old.
Yeah, it's a little different than it used to be.
Okay.
We kind of rethought some of the lyrics and we rethought just the feel of the song.
Let me play just a snippet of it then here. What's different now to what it was before?
Well, actually, some of the, I don't want to say effects, but the synthesizer type of thing where we didn't touch anything like that in the past.
Yeah, so Tommy was using a...
Yeah, he's using a Mellotron pedal, and we messed around with some studio keyboard type stuff.
Yeah, Eric Nelson, who recorded the record.
Yeah, props to Eric.
Genius.
Yeah.
Anybody out there that's going to be making a record locally, talk to Eric Nelson at Eclipse Studios.
Yeah,
this guy.
He really was a key bounce off.
He had about as much to do with the final sound of this record than we did. I mean, he was constantly coming up with ideas. How about if we add this? How about if we do this? How about you change that melody a little bit?
He had some keyboards
to that song and changed the lyrics from being a positive love song to a negative love song.
Well, that's it. It's very bittersweet.
Yeah, it's
beautiful
used to end
and heartbreaking.
With the guy landing in someone's arms, and then the new version, she lets him fall to the rock.
Why'd you do it that way?
I'm just a bitter old man.
Oh, this is great. Something Brothers fans so geeked about this, and I'm one of them. Great album. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for coming in. And if you're listening in your car, thanks for the ride.
Edwin Pierce and Scott Wilson of Bloomington's The Something Brothers speaking with GLT's John Norton. The Something Brothers play the GLT Summer Concert presented by CEFQ June 8th in downtown Bloomington. Also appearing, Bloomington's Third Street Down, Grammy Award winning Rebirth Brass Band and headliner, Adia Victoria. Discover other local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. When Brenda and Mike Brady of Normal decide to do something, they go all in. They take it to the limit, as the Eagles would put it, That's actually their song. GLT's Ryan Denham brings you the story of their lifelong experience as foster parents and now foster dog parents.
The Bradys started fostering kids about 40 years ago. They didn't have much money, but they had a big house. Figured this was a way they could help. Over the next 12 years, they fostered 253 kids. About a third came to the Bradys after physical abuse. Another third were abused sexually.
I used to tell them it was a lot like a desert flower, a little plant that looks pretty, doesn't have much, but just a little bit of rain, and all of a sudden, boy, it blooms and is a beautiful thing. Taking their paper they brought home from school and put it on the refrigerator, it was a really big deal because that just never happened to them before.
The kids all went through what they called Brenda's basic training, how to use silverware, how to pay for groceries, the little things that we all take for granted. It took a lot of emergency kids, phone calls in the middle of the night. Brenda once picked up an 8-year-old from the county jail. He was basically living on the street and had gotten into trouble with police.
Well, I went and picked him up from jail, and the day that I picked him up, he said, "Mama, I feel my feet turning now." And that was the cutest, and we're still in contact with him. He's one of our special kids.
And this was all on top of the regular responsibilities of their everyday life. Mike was working full-time in insurance. They had three biological kids of their own.
All three of them would agree it was a very, it was positive for them also. I think they got to appreciate what they had a little more and gain some understanding of what's going on out there in the world a little better than a lot of kids.
Their last ever foster kids were tough. It was a brother and sister. They were affected prenatally by drugs. The girl had tremors and terrors so bad, Mike had to quietly sneak in the back door of his own house after work so he wouldn't scare her. But Mike and Brenda, they don't quit.
When we decided to adopt these two kids, we just knew that we were not going to be able to have enough left over at the end of the day for any more than what we were taking on.
By the time they stopped fostering kids about 20 years ago, they had six forever kids, three biological, three adopted.
And that's how we became the Brady Bunch. And his name is Mike Brady, so it worked.
But as it turns out, Mike was kind of wrong. They did have a little bit left in the tank. So a few years ago, they started caring for pregnant dogs and their puppies, a new kind of foster care.
Well, this is the M litter, and it's Molly and Mandy and Misty and
Margo.
This is where radio and podcasting really don't do it justice. Just trust me when I say these little brown and black floofs were adorable. They've fostered 230 dog moms and puppies so far, most recently with Wishbone Canine Rescue. They've taken dogs who were in trouble. Their first was an American Bulldog who was skin and bones. Despite being pregnant, she lost all of her puppies.
People say, "How do you do it?" I cried a lot. That one I cried a lot because she broke my heart. But she just thrived, and she gained weight, and she got healthy, and she got strong, and she's been in a great adoptive home forever now.
It's a little different, dogs versus kids. This time, Mike is retired from the insurance business, and Brenda is working part-time as a nurse.
The puppies, the kids, the mama dogs, everything we have done, give us back more than we give them, or I would not be able to do it.
Their commitment is staggering. Last year, one of their children, the girl they adopted, now all grown up, was very sick with an autoimmune disease. She was being treated at a St. Louis hospital. But back in Normal, they had a mama dog with nine puppies who wouldn't let anyone else care for her. So Brenda and Mike would commute back and forth almost every day to check on both sides of their family.
And I'll tell you, it was pretty therapeutic after coming back from the hospital and being in that situation that was pretty dire. And to pick up puppies and snuggle with them for a while. They do a lot of good for us, too, you know.
Their daughter, Morgan, passed away last summer at age 26. Brenda and Mike have some experience saying goodbye. 250 foster kids, 230 foster dogs. They all walked out the door.
I can't lie. It's challenging. Some of the kids were a whole lot easier to give up than the others. And it was because of the teenage behavior sometimes. However, we also had awesome teenagers that I just loved to pieces. But anytime they're ready to move on, the puppies, the kids, the families needing their kids back, it's so rewarding, actually. And I constantly say it's better to break my heart letting them go, but knowing that they were loved and cared for and they know what real love is, than staying awake at night worrying about them not being cared for. I'd rather break my heart than theirs.
That's Brenda Brady and her husband Mike, the caregivers. Take it to the limit. I'm Ryan Denham.
Take it to the limit one more time.
This story debuted earlier this week on GLT's new daily podcast, The Leadoff. It's the second installment in a weekly feature we're calling More of That, Please, about unsung community servants. Know someone who should be featured? Submit your story ideas at wglt.org/leadoff. Tomorrow on Sound Ideas, join us for a community conversation about legalized recreational use of cannabis. Or you can join us this evening at 6 o'clock in the Circus Room of the Bone Student Center at Illinois State University for a live edition of Sound Ideas and a community conversation about the bill currently pending in Springfield. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Jenham, Don Norton, and thanks to Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner for stopping by. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.